This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. Advantage Inter in the Milan Derby Champions League semi-final. They blew their rivals away in the first 11 minutes. The ageless Edin Dzeko and the ageing Henrik Mkhitaryan with the goals as Inter were just better in every department. First to the ball, quicker, sharper. And but for the woodwork and perhaps a surprising overturned VAR decision, could be out of sight. If anything, Milan will be relieved this tie is still alive and will be praying Rafael Leao is fit for next week. There are interesting questions about the gulf in quality between the two semi-finals we've seen and the coverage in the UK. Also today, the big questions from the WSL. Chelsea a point behind Manchester United in the title race. They meet in the FA Cup final. There's a Premier League preview, a look ahead to the National League playoff final, Barry's starring role in a movie trailer. Your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Mark Langdon from The Racing Post, welcome.
Hi, Max.
Nicky Bandini, hello.
Morning.
Hello, Barry Glendenning.
Hello, Max Rushton.
Right, let's start then at the San Siro. Milan nil, Inter 2. Nicky, you were there. Atmosphere and the crowd seemed deafening. Before we get into the game, give us an idea of that and just how the city has been in the build-up.
Yeah, I think like the atmosphere at San Siro, I feel like this goes for a lot of Italian stadiums, if I'm honest, and I think it is something to do with organised fandom. It's to do with that ultra element, actually, which of course has its light and its dark, has its problems. But when you're inside San Siro, which of course is a huge stadium, it's 75,000 people, but there's this moment before kickoff, and I'm talking like an hour before kickoff, and I was down there on the sidelines because I was doing some work for Stan, as you know, and you've got all the different sort of sideline reporters at different slots doing their things, and there's a noise, there's a hubbub going on about an hour before kickoff, but then there's a moment when the home ultras go, all right, it's go time, and the volume goes from hubbub to deafening, to you can't hear the person standing a foot away from you, and it was really such a build up yesterday. I got to San Siro at 5:30 local time, and of course that's an hour later than UK time, so kickoff is 9 o'clock, but that's still 3.5 hours for kickoff, and it wasn't like a few people outside, it was absolutely sort of packed, ready to go outside, even though the gates weren't open yet, all the sort of food stands, everyone having a drink. And it was that sense of build-up from that and before that. I mean, it's been ever since the draw was known, and or at least ever since they won their games and we knew that this semi-final was going to happen. It's been building up in the city. But the tension building up in that last hour, once the noise started, was really so... It's strange because, you know, I'm there as someone who hasn't got a horse in the race. I'm not picking sides in this game, but I felt it. I felt nervous. I felt that edge. And it's a real thrill to be around on I think, occasions and days like that. Although in the end, once the game started, it felt like some of the tension came out of it. I felt quite quickly.
Yeah. And I wonder, was that tension? I mean, I read Johnny Liu's piece, which I thought was brilliant about it. And I felt the same, that when you think about playing your rival in a semi-final of the Champions League, it feels less about winning it and more about not losing it to them, you know?
Yeah, I think that's completely accurate. And I think it's all amplified in a bunch of different directions. I think, first of all, consider the fact that these teams haven't been in the habit of being here, right? So first of all, this is a chance that's going to be here. Maybe it'll be another generation before we see this again or longer. I mean, the last time they played each other in a semi-final was 20 years ago, but just the last time Milan were in a final, which they won, was 2007. For Inter, it was 2010. It's a long time. So there's that part of it. Then there's the part of it that actually neither of these teams has had a great domestic season. So if you want to qualify for the Champions League right now, that's not even certain for next season. They're fourth and fifth in the table. Then it's the fact of playing in a Champions League final. Then it's the fact of, but if we don't do it, if we miss out on a Champions League final, which is painful, losing a Champions League semi-final is painful, our rival might go and do it. They might win it. We might have to sit here and watch them win the Champions League, go and beat Real Madrid or Manchester City, and you might tell yourself, well, it's not likely those teams are better or whatever, but you know it can happen. It's a game of football. And all of those things have such a multiplier effect. I have a lot of cousins who support Inter, and I've been receiving some of the text messages I've had from them in the last couple of weeks have been very funny because they're basically all just acknowledging that they don't know how to sit down or calm down because they're so stressed the whole time.
It feels odd, Barry, to suggest that Pioli and Milan might be relieved and Inter slightly frustrated that this game finished 2-0 to Inter Milan.
I don't think it's odd to suggest that. I'd say Pioli and Milan are absolutely delighted to get away with a 2-0 defeat because it could have been a lot worse if the penalty hadn't been overturned, if that Calhanoglu rasper from distance hadn't hit the post. They had a chance or two themselves, but they started so badly. The absence of Rafael Leao, I think, can't be overstated. And then to lose Ismail Benacer early doors to injury, that's a huge loss as well, because being a Serie A side, they don't really have the money to have strength, the kind of strength and depth you see from Premier League sides in the Champions League. You know, even the Inter bench was considerably stronger than the Milan one. But I'd say Inter are probably delighted they won 2-0, and they definitely, you know, were protecting that 2-0 lead in the second half. They could have gone for the kill, could have finished the tie. And while Milan were pretty bad last night, I wouldn't rule out a comeback on their part. And if they were to come back and win this, Inter will be, then they will regret only winning 2-0. But I, for the time being, I'd imagine they're quite happy with that. Delighted, in fact.
Yeah. And Eduardo says, can Edin Dzeko win the Champions League before Manchester City? He was great, but not just the goal, but sort of in this sort of battle of two, I was going to say old, haggard target men, but that's no way to describe Olivier Giroud, is it? And, you know, but to see him play so well, and I guess in a sense for people with Premier League blinkers, of which I probably am one, to realise that you, just because a player leaves the Premier League doesn't mean that they just instantly go to the glue factory, you know?
No, and I mean, Dzeko's been sort of at it in Italy for a long time and been very effective. And even on, I was listening to some of the radio coverage before the game, and there was sort of a sense of surprise maybe that Dzeko was in ahead of Lukaku. And that, again, might be down to some kind of just Premier League bias, maybe. But I also think, in terms of comparing those two forwards, you know, it's a lot easier for that target man to thrive and look good when there are other players making runs beyond. And, you know, so Lautaro Martinez obviously was causing problems. You had the wing backs, particularly Dimarco down the left-hand side. There's a lot of quality in the midfield, Mkhitaryan, Shalanolu, and also Barella, who I thought was fantastic once again. So, you know, Giroud maybe would have looked better had Leao been there to kind of just offer that threat in behind that then creates sort of space and opportunities maybe to get those crosses in. It was very difficult for Giroud to get into the game. But now, you know, Dzeko is still doing, you know, a fine job. And I do think it's another thing that's interesting is that if you believe in kind of the underlying stats and, expected goals and expected points, Inter are very close to Napoli this season on those metrics. And the league table says, of course, that there's, you know, miles between the two. But this was one of them performances maybe where it did come together for Inter, and they were able, you know, they've left a lot of goals on the table really this season so far. And they were able to take those early opportunities that really, you know, killed the game early on.
Just to pick up on what Mark was just saying there, I think it's really interesting because I know a lot of people, when Napoli went out to Milan, looked around and went, oh, it's just a shame. Napoli have been so great. And wouldn't it sort of be better for the competition to have Napoli? They might be able to upset Man City. And I think you can say two things at once, which is that Napoli absolutely have been the best team in Serie A this season, deserve to win their title by a mile, which is what they've done. But I'm actually not sure they're the best team in Italy today. And I think that's a really sort of important nuance. Napoli's season has faded, and there's all sorts of reasons for that, which is a different subject for a different day. Whereas Inter, as Mark's suggesting just then, they were supposed to compete for the title. They were the team, frankly, who everyone expected to win this Scudetto, them or Juventus probably at the start of the season, certainly not Napoli. And it's because, and this comes to what Baz was saying, actually they do have great depth. You know, you had Simone Inzaghi yesterday making some difficult decisions between, do I start Lukaku, who's got 3 goals and 3 assists in his last 3 games, or Dzeko up front? Do I start Calhanoglu in midfield, or do I start Brozovic, who's a brilliant footballer, who's everyone's been seeing what he can do with Croatia again at the World Cup, but he's been doing that in Serie A for years. And these are genuine choices, which Milan don't really have, especially not when you take out Leao, and even more when you take out Bennacer, who I think is that move to push him up to a number 10 role was a real sort of pivot point towards better things for them in the second part of the season. So the depth is a really big issue. And I do think Inter were supposed to be better than they've been in the league this season, but they have delivered it in the cups. And it's actually kind of astonishing when you look at Simone Inzaghi's cup record since he's been there. I mean, last season he won the Supercoppa and the Coppa Italia. This season he's won the Supercoppa. He's in the Coppa Italia final this month, and now he's on the verge of a Champions League final. He's not been able to get consistency out of that team, but when push comes to shove, he has got results out of them in every knockout competition there is.
And yet he's under pressure, Nikki.
Yeah, because they might not make the top four, which is crazy because they were supposed to be a contender for the league title. I think it's a sort of fascinating subplot to this game, actually, which we talked about last night, Max, which is that you've got two clubs in the semi-final of the Champions League you don't necessarily expect to see in the semi-final of the Champions League these days. It's been a long time, as we were just talking about. And yet both of their managers are under pressure because Pioli, it's the same thing. They're fifth in the table. It's not certain how his job security is. But I would say in Inzaghi's case, it's trending in a better direction because, again, calling back to what Mark just said, like the underlying numbers have been good. The results are now good. And they're looking, to me, the more likely the two to finish in the top four. And if they finish in the top four and reach Champions League final, you'd be pretty hard pressed to turn around and say to him he's not done a good enough job.
Yeah. That penalty decision, Barry, Simon Kjær miscontrols it. Martinez gets past him. He tries to pull him down. Whether he successfully gets enough of the shirt to cause him to go down is a different question. Rio Ferdinand and Stephen Gerrard on BT said they thought it was a penalty. Ex-pros who I trust, Craig Foster and Mark Bosnich, also said it was a penalty, but I wasn't so sure, or at least I was pleased it was overturned.
Yeah, Pat Nevin, who I would trust more than any of the others you mentioned, I think he didn't think it was a penalty. I thought on first view it was. The ref is obviously summoned to the screen, has a look and overturns the decision. And I think he was probably right to do that because I didn't think it was a foul, having seen replays. Was it a clear and obvious error on the referee's part? That is a matter of opinion, I suppose. And that's therein lies the problem with VAR, because ultimately it's still a human making the decision. I'm glad for the sake of the tie it was overturned. I personally don't think it was a penalty. I think when the ref goes to the screen, it's not did you make the wrong decision, it's did you make a clear and obvious error. I don't think he necessarily did, but that, again, that is a matter of opinion.
Jake says, and we had a lot of questions like this, and this is perhaps the most sensationist of it, Nikki, but it says, have you ever seen a bigger disparity in quality between two Champions League semi-finals? It reminds me of watching a Premier League game on TV, then going to my son's under sevens football. I have to readjust expectations on what the players can actually do. And I mean, I you know, I'm not trying to be provocative. And actually, I thought you mentioned Pat Nevin. I thought he was really interesting on this subject last night on Five Live when he said, it's not insulting to say this game is going to be a lower quality than Real Madrid-Man City. It's just understanding the financial positions of all of these sides, right?
Yeah, I think people can sort of exaggerate these things in their minds as well. I agree that the Real Madrid-Man City game was played at a higher quality, but I also think it's worth reminding ourselves. Inter did knock Barcelona out of this competition, and Milan did knock Tottenham and Napoli out of this competition. They haven't sort of got here by winning a lucky dip. Like, they've beaten teams to get here. And I think excluding the possibility that one of these teams could win the final yet is silly, in my opinion. Having said that, yes, whichever of these teams wins it is going to be the underdog. And I think that when you go player for player through these teams, you get exactly what you expect, which is richer teams can afford a higher quality of player. It's sort of came up last night, again on the broadcast, Max, but Hakan Çalhanoğlu was saying not so long ago he thinks he belongs in the top five midfielders in, or deep lying midfielders that exist in the world. He sort of puts himself in that category alongside explicitly naming sort of Modric and Casemiro, saying, I think I'm, you know, I belong with that group of players. And I think a lot of people hear that and raise an eyebrow at it and want to mock it. But look, he was good last night. He set up the first goal, he hit the woodwork, and he's going to get a chance to prove it one way or another, right? Because he's going to be playing against potentially some of those players in the final. So we'll see. But yes, it was a lesser of the two finals, the two semi-finals in terms of absolute quality for sure.
Something else I wanted to ask you, Nicky, was about the rivalry, about, you know, the historic rivalry between Milan and Inter, because it's not based on religion or class or sort of acrimony, is it? I was just trying to gauge sort of what it is. Like, what is their hatred? As in Johnny's piece, he sort of mentioned, actually, it sort of seems sometimes both sets of fans hate Juve more than they hate each other. What is the rivalry?
Yeah, I think Johnny captured it really nicely in his piece. It's a lovely piece he wrote. There isn't this sort of obvious divide that you get in some cities. There's not Glasgow where you've got religion as a divide. It's not Boca against River where you've got class as a divide, whether it's wealthy or poor. And it's not even sort of Rome where you have a regional sort of divide or like a neighbourhoods divide. You know, in Rome, Lazio and Roma, that really comes down to what part of the city you were born in. Inter were literally sort of created from Milan. They were a split-away club. All at the time, it was all because of rules about international sort of limits on foreign players you could have in a team. And they've sort of grown up together, sort of in symbiosis. And in many ways, there is a rivalry of incredible parity. I mean, they've both won 19 league titles, Max, exactly the same number. They're both competing right now to be the first one that gets the second star on their shirts. And yes, Milan have won more often in Europe. They've got 7 Champions Leagues to Inter's 3, but this is still the only city anywhere in Europe where you can say more than one team has won the Champions League. Now, Manchester might join that group soon, but we'll see. So it's really been a rivalry that's sort of all its own, and in which you've seen really big players play for both teams. Ronaldo, I saw last night at both ends of the pitch, there was one moment I looked across and I saw an Inter banner for Roberto Baggio. I looked up and saw immediately a Milan banner for Roberto Baggio because he played for both teams, you know. Ibrahimovic, Pirlo, Seedorf, so many players who've played for both teams, which you don't see often in city rivalries. So there is this idea in Milan that rather than sort of bitter enemies, they call each other cugini, cousins. They're the cousins who you like to wind up. I did see one stand of Milan memorabilia as I was on the way out last night, which said, I don't have any cousins, you know, which I thought was sort of the extent to which this sort of rivalry goes sometimes. So look, there's still nastiness sometimes. It's enough to remember 18 years ago when they played in the quarterfinals and a flare gets thrown at Dida and the whole game gets suspended. There have been bad incidents, but I think compared to some rivalries, it feels more like a rivalry about, you know, whose prestige, whose history is greater, rather than a rivalry about, oh, we hate these guys and it's the bitterest thing you can imagine.
We had quite a lot of questions, Barry, about the coverage in the UK. Matt says, rather than have Serie A experts on, can you please have guests on who haven't watched Italian football in 30 years? I opt for the BT Sport approach that everyone's enjoyed this evening. Ken says, talk about BT and nothing else, a fascinating production. What explains it? I mean, I tend to watch the Australian coverage, which is excellent. And I'm loath to criticise other broadcasters just for the sake of it, because, you know, it's not necessarily the most straightforward thing to do in the world. Expectations are quite high. It might have been brilliant. I don't know. But was there anything particularly remiss yesterday? I was just interested in why we got so many questions on that subject.
Well, thanks for throwing that one to me, Max. Another nice hospital pass. Look, but I suppose before I get to talk about BT, Jake Humphrey hosts the BT podcast or coverage. I'm not a fan of his, but that's not really anything to do with his hosting ability. I just find his whole world-class basics, high-performance, LinkedIn shtick disingenuous. That's why I'm not a fan of Jake Humphrey. As far as the coverage is concerned, I find BT Sports coverage of football and Champions League football in particular quite bad. It's humorless, it's too chummy, it's too matey. But ultimately, I'm there to watch the football, so the coverage isn't that important. A lot of people seem quite upset that last night they seem to think because BT's Serie A coverage is very good that they should have had Jimbo and James Horncastle presenting it. James Horncastle had a role, and presenting the Champions League football is Jake's gig. So, you know, he can't just be expected to stand aside and let Jimbo do it because Jimbo knows more about Serie A football than him. There did seem to be an air last night that who were the pundits? Is it Owen Hargreaves, Peter Crouch, Steven Gerrard and Hargreaves, was it?
Rio Ferdinand.
And Rio was at the game with James Horncastle. They don't watch Serie A football, but, you know, here am I discussing the game, and I don't watch very much Serie A football either, so I'm certainly not going to criticise them for that. I suspect, Max, you don't watch a great deal of it. I know Nicky does, and Mark seems to spend his entire life watching football from all over Europe and beyond. So, you know, I'm not going to criticise them for that because that would be very hypocritical. But by and large, I do find their Champions League coverage pretty dull. And they, I'm not a fan of the fact that they always latch on to, you know, refereeing controversies. That's their go-to thing to discuss rather than good play or what happened here or why is this not working? Why is there gaping holes in Milan's midfield? So, yeah, that I suppose is my take on it.
But you ran with that hospital pass, so thanks, Barry. Mark?
Well, I think a lot of people are complaining about Rio Ferdinand sort of being in the stadium, and they dropped him into sort of the Peter Walton role where he would, you know, just pop up every 15 or 20 minutes and then not really have long enough to actually speak about the game. And so you just got, you know, a 10-second soundbite where he just goes something like, oh, this is amazing, or, you know, the crowd noise is fantastic. You know, that's not, you know, that doesn't really impact on the viewer. I agree with Barry that, you know, I don't think they should just rip up their Champions League coverage to start bringing in people that are absolute experts in Serie A. But it would be nice if the people that are doing it had spent 10 minutes research. You know, I don't think it's that difficult if your job is to be on sort of, you know, a big TV broadcast for a Champions League semi-final, that if you haven't watched these two teams that much, that you, I mean, I know somebody, for instance, that does a lot, a former professional, and he will ring me up often and just say, I'm doing RZ Alkmaar or whatever. You know, can you just, you know, what do you know about them? And I'll happily spend a couple of minutes. I don't know if Nicky gets the same from anyone, but you definitely, you know, there are some that take it more serious than others. I really don't like it when a former pro turns up and thinks that it's okay to just be on the broadcast and just, you know, their medals be a good enough reason for them to talk about the game.
Is the former pro you speak of Don Hutchison by any chance?
It's not, actually. So I was Alkmaar was just something I just threw out there. But
no, I just, because he does stuff on BT and I find him excellent, and he's clearly done a lot of homework in a manner in which more famous former footballers than Don Hutchison haven't.
He would be of a similar kind of level, I would say, Barry. So he's not somebody that, you know, is Steven Gerrard standard, yeah.
Yeah, but we know that from talks. But, you know, guys like Tony Cascarino, Perry Groves doing, like, a lot of work, like, take the job incredibly seriously. It was interesting with BT that, you know, the goal show is brilliant, right? I don't know who any of those guys are, but it's great. They brought in journalists to be on, like, Score, which Sky haven't done, you know. They brought in, like, Rory Smith has done it, Lars has done it, you know, other people have done it. Hi Pod fans, Football Weekly is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted to League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May the 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu. So they're not averse to getting experts in, even if they haven't played loads of football. Anyway, that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll do a Premier League preview. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's look at the games in the Premier League then this weekend. Everton, Man City. Mark, can Sean Dyche mastermind another victory? I mean, I still can't work out where that you know, exhibition of counter-attacking football against Brighton came from.
No, nor can I. The early goal makes a big difference if you are a team that wants to play on the break. But I thought all over the pitch, they played fantastically. In terms of Pickford was great. I thought Yerry Mina coming in made a difference to the defence. The midfield, Decore seemed to be everywhere. You know what you're going to get from Idrissa Gueye. I think Garner, actually, somebody that's come in quite recently. I hadn't noticed him too much, but I've liked what I've seen from him. And then, Dwight McNeil kind of, turning into Messi has certainly helped. And also Calvert-Lewin being back just can knit it all together. He looks fit again, which has been a problem for them. I think they can make it awkward for Manchester City, because I am expecting Guardiola, given he didn't make changes during the game against Real Madrid, and the return leg is so important. I am expecting changes, and while they're bringing in quality, if it's Mahrez, Foden, Julian Alvarez, players of that calibre, I just think from a rhythm point of view, it doesn't always work, does it, if you maybe make five or six changes. And so there is the potential, I think, there for Everton to make life you're uncomfortable maybe for Manchester City. I would still expect City to eventually find a route to victory. And the fact that they're able to lose one game and still win the league, I think does make a difference just from a pressure point of view. And if Arsenal can get it to where, there's no more mistakes for Manchester City, it could be different. But while they've got that buffer, it's a nice position to be in for City to know that they can drop points somewhere.
The Everton side of it is one side of it, and there's the Brighton side of it as well. And De Zerbi's a great manager who I admire a lot, but his teams have always had this sort of result in them because of the way they play, because they take risks, because they like to go one-on-one with people. And if you push that, sometimes, every now and then, someone's going to just catch you out. And I think City don't do that. City aren't going to take the sort of risks against Everton that Brighton expose themselves to.
And actually, De Zerbi being who he is, and you will know this better than I do, Nikki, they go to Arsenal. I get the impression that he won't want two performances like that together. In fact, that defeat might be the worst possible result for Arsenal going into an Arsenal-Brighton game.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly is like a... I don't think that's just De Zerbi. Any manager's going to use that as an excuse to give their team a kick up the bum, aren't they? You've just got hammered by a team in a relegation fight. You can't perform. Like that again, and now you're playing a team at the top of the table. All the motivation is in the right place for it, definitely.
Yeah, but I guess that victory that you had at Newcastle must give you hope, right? Like, what you have to do, and we've said it before on this pod, is you just have to be in the position if City do screw it up.
I feel like every time I come on this podcast, you try to coax me into like having some hope, Max. Every time I come on, it's always like, why don't you believe Arsenal are going to win the league?
What's your hope percentage at this stage
now?
Zero.
Yeah. For me, but it's not based on Arsenal, it's based on Manchester City. And I think that's the thing. Like, I know everyone wanted to get into the bottling conversation, and Arsenal had the lead, and they did, and they let slip. But at some point, everyone's going to have to look at the number of games City have won in a row and go, that's quite unusual. That's not actually like normal for a football team just to win that many games without dropping any points anywhere. So that's the reason it's hard to have any hope, is because that team's a juggernaut.
At Elland Road, Leeds play Newcastle, one of Big Sam's former clubs coming to Elland Road. When I said, and you and I said this on the pod, Barry, that every football fan, barring Man City fans, wanted Leeds to beat Man City, a few Newcastle fans got in touch with me to say, that isn't the case. We don't want Big Sam to have any success at all. How do you see this one going? Can you see... I mean, the atmosphere at Elland Road will be great, won't it?
Yeah, I would expect Newcastle to win. They are a much better team than Leeds. I wasn't impressed with Leeds' performance against Manchester City, even though they only lost 2-1 away. We'll see what Sam has done with them in the week that passed between games. They may get a result, but you would expect Newcastle to win, and probably win quite comfortably.
Do you see, Mark, Nottingham Forest getting anything from Chelsea, who are now on a wild winning run, aren't they?
I don't, just because Nottingham Forest have been so bad away from home virtually all season. okay, it was a better show at Liverpool when they lost 3-2, but generally speaking, all of their good work has been done at home. And I think Nedham was on the pod a couple of weeks ago and just saying he just expected Chelsea to win every game because he just looked at the team. And I sort of I was in that position and then finally gave up on them against Bournemouth and thought this is another one that they won't win. And then they did win. But when you look at the players, and okay, there are motivational issues and many other problems there, they're still considerably better than Nottingham Forest and should be able to win that game even if they're not at full tilt. So I was just looking at how many points you might need to stay up. I was thinking it could be 34. So Leeds potentially need like 4 from those 3 games. Forest, because of their goal difference, might need 2, 1 potentially. So I don't think it will come here. And then they've got Arsenal.
I think it's only 34. It's interesting.
Problem is, Max, we always think that teams at the bottom are suddenly going to start winning games, but they're down at the bottom because they're not. They don't win very many matches. And so, you know, you look at Leicester, they've got Liverpool, they've got Newcastle. I mean, I don't see anything really from those 2 games. And then they've got West Ham on the final day. I just think we start giving teams at the bottom too much credit at this stage of the season just because they need to win rather than what they've actually done for the whole season.
You couldn't be more right. I mean, I literally look at the bottom of the league table and I add on 100% of the points. So they got 3, they get 9 points. If they got 3 games left, they get 9 points. Even though you're right, Leicester playing Liverpool and then Newcastle. I've managed, Nicky, to predict. I do like this predictor thing with some mates. And I've managed to get Tottenham into the Champions League by predicting defeats for Liverpool, Brighton and Manchester United for the rest of the season. Despite the fact that, you're right, Liverpool play Leicester and Manchester United play Wolves. So, I mean, I guess the only thing is Liverpool on this really good run, aren't they? So United and Newcastle just need to, you know, 1 or 2 more wins should be enough for them.
You would think so, yeah. I don't want to burst your bubble on your Premier League predictor, but the form suggests maybe not.
No, there's no green in Tottenham's form, is there? Look, in the vaguely meaningless games, Villa play Spurs. We'd upset Villa and Wolves fans by saying their game was meaningless. It wasn't on Monday. I know it meant a lot to Wolves and sort of guaranteed their Premier League status. And, you know, Villa are still have European aspirations, as do Tottenham. Southampton play Fulham. Southampton need an absolute miracle to survive.
Could I just state, yes, Max, that it was you who said that Wolves Villa was meaningless and elected not to give it any airtime beyond that, and nothing to do with me?
Well, it's nothing to do with you, but it is something to do with you. It's to do with the panel like to talk, and I have no problem with having a panel who like to talk. You know, especially having interviewed lots of indie bands in the Soccer and Glory years, which is like blood from a stone. However, like sometimes we have to rush along and I get notes saying, can you rush along? Because the ideal duration of a podcast is 55 minutes and we're always over that. I don't know who makes that duration, but it's not my fault either.
I mean, we're going to be in trouble on Monday because, I mean, just what a weekend of football that's coming up. We have the Premier League games. You got the Championship, League One, League Two, playoff semis, National League final playoff, Old Firm Celtic being coronated, or Celtic's coronation against Rangers, and the Women's FA Cup final. It's a lot of stuff, Max. Mm. What are you going to leave out?
I don't know, but if I leave anything out, it's because I don't like that team and that league, and it's all on me. So, yes. Just to mention all the games in the Premier League, Palace, Bournemouth, real last on match of the day vibes for that one, and Brentford, West Ham on Sunday. And obviously West Ham have got European football tonight against AZ Alkmaar, so, and they're pretty much safe, aren't they? So they'll probably rest a few. Chesterfield, Notts County, one of the games that Barry mentioned there, Mark, in the National League playoff final, after those utterly ridiculous semi-finals. I mean, they should. I imagine they'll all just be absolutely shattered still. They'll all just be in a heap, sort of wheeled on. And they'd rather just sit on beanbags and watch romantic comedies. Just put Sleepless in Seattle on, and the squads can both watch them with some kittens walk around their feet. But they've got to play a football match.
They have. I mean, it was ridiculous semi-finals. And then obviously we had the madness of Monday as well. Sort of exhausting just watching it. But I'm Notts County, one of my favourite teams to watch this season. Their football I love Napoli. Manchester City are always, quite interesting. And, in France, you've got somebody like Lens that, I think are doing great. But, like, Notts County's football is, to me, much more pleasurable than watching my own sort of team. I support Tottenham, and that's a chore. And
that's not hard, Mark. I mean, that is a low bar.
It is, but, so I really like what Luke Williams, the Notts County coach, has done in terms of, football should be enjoying, shouldn't it? It shouldn't be like hard work. It's entertainment. It might be a job for the players and the manager, but as a manager, you can choose to be anything as a coach. Your philosophy can be at one end of the scale or the other. And I just don't know why sort of everybody doesn't choose a Deserby approach, or in this case, Luke Williams, because even when they were chasing that match in the semi-final, and it's ridiculous that they're even in the playoffs, 107 points, 117 goals, to not go up automatically is outrageous, really. And I think that the one up automatically probably needs looking at. They do need to go to a 3-down in League Two. But to then be 2-0 down in that playoff semi-final, but even in the sort of injury time, they were still sticking to the process and still trying to play the football and create space for the wide players and just, move it from defence through midfield. Absolute joy to watch. So I hope that they do it against Chesterfield. There's a good story for Chesterfield as well. I mean, Paul Cook back in charge of the Spireites. He had promotions, didn't he, with Chesterfield, also with Wigan. Had a terrible time at Ipswich. Wasn't the only one that sort of failed to get Ipswich going. Ended up back down at Chesterfield, and they had a good season themselves. Finished third on 84 points. So, but that was still obviously a distance behind Notts County. So, I think it will be a game sort of fit for Wembley. They have moved it around. Not always played that playoff final at Wembley, but I think it is that is the rightful home for it. The ticketing prices seem to be back at a level. There was also some fans not happy maybe in some years with the ticketing prices. They have looked at that. But anybody that's paid for a ticket should get a really good game on Saturday. And, if you're at a miss and not watching any other game, then I advise you to tune in. It should be fun.
We had a go at BT earlier, but their coverage of non-league football is excellent. Yeah, I have to say.
Yeah, Adam Summerton, who does the Serie A as well, is top class.
Yeah, he's brilliant, isn't he? He's great. Yeah, totally. That's good balance. Hopefully the BT execs have listened all the way through, just in case they were going to hire us, Barry, before the end of part one. That'll do then for part two. Susie Rack will join us. We'll talk WSL in a second. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's get a roundup from the WSL. Susie Rack, Guardian Women's Football Correspondent, joins us. Hey, Susie.
Hey, how are you doing, guys?
Yeah, good, thank you. So a couple of straightforward wins for Chelsea and Arsenal yesterday. Chelsea 6-0 over Leicester. Arsenal 4-0 at Brighton, which means the top of the league. What, Chelsea were in the box seat, I'd say. They've got a game in hand on Manchester United. They're a point behind. But it isn't over, because on the 21st, there's this massive day where Chelsea play Arsenal and Manchester United play Manchester City.
Oh, it's great. It's just like the tastiest title race in years. I mean, it was tight last season, but like, it's never been four-way like this and this close. And there, so many nuances to it with those two games coming up. The thing is with Chelsea, they've had, by their standards, a relatively average season in terms of like performances. We've been so used to like Sam Kerr, Frank Kirby, Pernille Harder sort of swaggering through. Injuries to Pernille and Fran have meant that they've sort of almost like staggered across the line a little bit. But in May, just regardless, no matter what happens, they're just a different beast. They've just got this relentlessness to them. I mean, they've closed a 13 goal difference gap on Man United in two games to bring it down to zero. They've got a game in hand over them and they're 1 point behind. It's just like they've got their like foot on the throat and they're ready to squeeze it, basically. Yeah, they're just absolutely dogged. And Pernille Harder coming back at this moment has been pretty perfect for them, because Sam Kerr, I mean, like, as she would battle through to get to the World Cup and play it, even if she had like two broken legs and a missing arm, but she looks pretty exhausted. So having Pernille come back in, get two goals and assist coming off the bench last week, and then get two goals and another assist last night, playing like 70 minutes or something, is just massive, like absolutely huge. So, I mean, for me, for weeks, I've not been able to look past Chelsea for the title, regardless of like how good Manchester United are doing, regardless of how bad Chelsea have been, regardless of the like toll of the Champions League exit, all of those things are just like, come May, when there's trophies on the line, Chelsea are relentless. But then it's the FA Cup final between the pair this weekend as well, which is like, could have a say either way, weirdly, in that like it will either, you know, really spur on whoever loses it to really, really grind out for the title, could exhaust Chelsea if they win it, who knows? Or like, you know, basically either team have got a double, a trophy apiece, or nothing on the table. And like, that's quite exciting.
Yeah, it's great. I was just wondering, can you put your finger on why Chelsea, or how Chelsea have sort of turned that around? I wonder if like the Champions League exit sort of piqued their interest, that's the wrong phrase, but, you know, focused their mind, where Emma Hayes suddenly went, look, we don't want to end the season with nothing, guys, or, you know, without a major title.
I don't know. I think it's like, the thing is they've still been winning, right? Like, they're still in second, won 16 games, lost two, drawn one. Like, their record is still incredibly strong. But they, yeah, it just hasn't been as, like, cantering and like beautiful to watch, and it's just that's what's switched, that's what's turned. And I think Pernille Harder coming back is a big part of that. But in terms of like the way they step it up in May, maybe it comes with the experience of winning, the experience of being in this position so many times. You know, this is, if they won the double, it'd be their third straight double, which is great for them, less great for the like optics of the league in what has actually been one of the most competitive seasons ever in the WSL. But yeah, I think they've just got a wet, like, I mean, Emma Hayes talks about it a lot. She recruits people who are like problem solvers on the pitch. You know, she's got a lot of captains in her squad. She recruits people that can, you know, whether she's on the sideline or not, can cope without her. So like, to a certain extent. And, you know, I'd say this season tactically she's been tested a little bit, and has maybe made a few wrong decisions in the League Cup final against Arsenal. There was like a late change in the first half to a back three that then reverted to a back four in the second half again, like really, like quite bizarre. And they really struggled in that game, and they had lost it in the first half. So there's been some weird tactical decisions, but for some reason, like, the players, the mentality of the players, the group that she's put together, just have this ability just to sort of shift up a gear in May in a way that, like, it means that you can just never, ever bet against them. I would never, ever bet against Chelsea. Like, if they've got the title in their hands, regardless of what position they are in the league, to win it, I just would never, ever make that bet.
Has Emma Hayes ever hinted at sort of how long she might want to carry on doing this? Not in a kind of, when will she go and manage a random League Two men's team, but just in a, she might just want to go and do something else. And like, would the impact of her leaving Chelsea be similar to sort of the conversation about, say, Pep leaving Man City?
Oh, 100%. I think it would definitely be that level of conversation. It'd be huge. Irreplaceable in terms of the way the whole of Chelsea women's setup has been like built from her, from one chair in one room to like a whole hub there. So she, like, her hands have touched absolutely every element of progress at that club for 10 years. So like, yeah, it would be a huge, huge loss. But it's a conversation that sort of comes up time and time again, because she desperately, I think if she won the Champions League, she would be gone. And she desperately wants it, but they still feel a fair way from that. So it's, how long does she wait to like kind of almost give up on that dream with Chelsea and maybe go and do it somewhere else, or do it with a national team, or move to a men's side or something? Or does she keep pushing for that? And I think that's the internal battle she's probably having every single season, every time they come out of the Champions League. But like, I would like, she speaks Spanish. I would love to see her manage the Spain national team.
Susie, how does that, like what you talked about there, that desire to win the Champions League, interact then with the sort of strong possibility, it sounds like, that Harder and Eriksen might move on this summer, like as the contracts are up? Is that going to be, that feels like a potential inflection point for any team to have two players go at the same time like that, especially when they're as good as them.
Yeah, and from what I hear, it's like that they, you know, really would like to stay sort of long term, but maybe can't get that commitment out of Chelsea. Obviously, they come as a pair to a certain extent at this stage of their careers and their lives and stuff. And so it's like how they juggle that. But like as I understand it, they've got like some really good players lined up to come in. All of the talk is of Catherine Macario at Lyon, who's a phenomenal young forward, US international, who has been brilliant this season. She's sort of come in later into the campaign because she had an ACL injury, as everyone in the world of women's football has at the moment. And but yeah, I mean, she's no Pernille Harder, who is obviously significantly experienced, has won the Champions League, like is just incredible in so many ways. Like her game is just so complete, but she's so, so talented and, you know, ready to slot in to a certain extent and prove herself at the very, very top level, which she's already started to do at Lyon. So they have been like making moves to bring in players. I think Ashley Lawrence is a defender that they've been looking at who would probably be a replacement for Harder. They brought in Buchanan last summer, who has sort of underperformed, like below expectation, I would say, having come from Lyon, but sort of struggled to keep up with the pace of the league. But they've already sort of, I mean, Emma Hayes always says she's working sort of 2, 3, 4 years ahead. And there's been times, you know, watching them last night, I was like, how could they let them leave? They're both brilliant. They could go on for seasons more. Like, don't do it. But then I thought that when Emma let Katie Chapman go and Karen Carney and Gilly Flaherty, I was like, what is she doing? She's mad. She lost her mind. But she all, like, I have like given up on trying to second guess Emma Hayes and her decision making, because often it ends up being pretty correct. Although, yeah, I mean, Eriksen has struggled for game time this season, but when she's come in at the end of the season, she'd be brilliant. Harder, I mean, I don't know how any team could not see that as a loss, but yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see how they sort of transition through that, especially with, you know, Frank Kirby's injury situation sort of up and down and up and down constantly.
Susie, you mentioned Lyon there, you know, the real flag bearers at one stage for women's football, and Orlas, the club president, was you know, a big supporter of women's football. He's leaving Lyon. Is that set to impact on the women's team at all, or do you think they'll be able to sort of carry on?
You'd like to think it won't impact too much, given that they are like 8-time European champions and that they're so embedded in the club and that the ethos of the club, like every single player that's played at Lyon and that talks about it, just like so many clubs talk about one club mentality and values and all of that. But like a lot of them say that Lyon is where it's at, where it actually feels real. So you'd like to think that won't end, but I mean, he's been such a driving force, like in pushing player wages up and things like that, and really like driving, like setting the standard and pushing the bar higher out of principle, not just out of because he has to, because someone else is bidding more. He's been the one pushing that bar higher and higher and higher, because he says, I interviewed him a couple of years ago, he was like, the players deserve it. Like, they deserve to be paid more than they're being paid. If I could pay them the same as the men's, from an economical point of view, I would, but I'm also a businessman. I have to run a business. I have to like set the bar somewhere and, you know, kind of do the maths to work out what is more fair, but also affordable for me to do. The worry for me is that those kind of principles go with just this ideological belief in women's football and women football players being treated fairly and equitably and really valued as a part of the team and pioneered on principle. Like, I worry that will go and that they'll become a little bit more like a Chelsea or a Man City or a Barcelona, where there's a lot of talk about the one club mentality, but like under the surface, it's not quite as like ideologically committed to those kind of principles. So yeah, that's the fear for me. It'll be interesting to see, you know, who they sign in the summer, because, you know, Ada Hegerberg has been there a long time. There's been rumours that she might leave. If Katerina Macario goes to Chelsea, that's another like big one for the future that they're sort of letting go. Whereas obviously Ada Hegerberg's been a bit older and has been there a bit longer. So seeing what they do in the summer, which has generally been like signed sort of Galactico level players, like with Orlas gone, is going to be really interesting, because he's been the one who has been having those conversations and recruiting those players and making the promises and being able to promise Champions League trophies, essentially, which they're not even in the final this season. So the conversations will switch a little bit, and it's going to be interesting to see how that pans out for them and whether it starts to see them decline at all.
Susie, thanks for coming on. Always nice to talk to you. Massive summer, of course. Women's World Cup. Guardian Women's Football Weekly is on every Tuesday. They will, of course, be covering it. We'll be covering it as well. For the time being, thanks for coming on, Susie.
Cheers for having me.
Susie Rack there, Guardian Women's Football Correspondent. Just time for a little bit of AOB. Robbie says, how big of a fanboy of Messi is Max? In the pod yesterday, you were literally in denial Messi was going to Saudi Arabia. You said he's at least aging better than Ronaldo. Messi's 35. At 35, Ronaldo won his second Serie A and was top scorer. At 36, he was golden boot. That's a fair point. I prefer Messi as a footballer. Don't love either of them as blokes. Hope that's okay. Matthew says, on the subject of people demanding we talk about their clubs, it's getting out of hand now. Can I bully you all to talk about the USL's Pittsburgh Riverhounds? Sounds like a club that Barry has made up. Perhaps I haven't even checked if it's real. What was yours? What was it? The Western Timberlakes or something?
Woodland Timberlakes.
Woodland Timberlakes. They just beat the New England Revolution in the US Open Cup. Thanks. Looking forward to the segment. Yeah, we'll add it to the in tray, Matthew. Lawrence says, after Barry's unexpected cameo in the trailer for that Peter Crouch film, is this the start of a fledgling movie career? So it was exciting, Barry, wasn't it? I watched the trailer. You don't see your face, but you do hear your velvety tones.
Yeah, there's probably a good reason for that. This is news to me. It's the first I've heard of it. So could you elaborate?
There's Peter Crouch has got a film coming out about how it's the story of Peter Crouch, which you may know.
Yeah.
He was quite a gangly chap who was quite good at football.
I am familiar with his work, yes.
I think as a youngster, he probably got a bit teased for being gangly. Turns out he was really good at football, had quite a good career. It seems like a nice bloke, has a nice wife and a nice family. But within it, at some point, it cuts to your voice over an image of him playing, scoring an overhead kick or something, saying he's turned into a national treasure. Did they record you surreptitiously? Did you get interviewed for this?
No. I got interviewed for it. And luckily, I had done, you know, a lot of preparation for this interview, which I thought would take about 10 minutes. And I basically got grilled for over 2 hours. Now,
wow.
I'm guessing
like an FBI interrogation.
I'm not joking. It was intense, very intense. And I'm glad I had put the work in, because otherwise it would have been a disaster. But my worry is that my contribution will probably be limited to about a minute, and I'm terrified I'll get stitched up, that they'll only take out mildly critical things I said about Crouchy and use them to make me look like some sort of anti-Crouch heel. But I would like to state for the record, ahead of the release of this film, that I am a massive, massive Peter Crouch fan.
Right. I mean, it sounds like you're sort of worried they're going to sort of try and get you in the narrative arc as the evil baddie. I'm not sure you'll play that pivotal a role, is my hunch. But look, you never know.
Oh, no, I suspect, you know, that's the thing they do with these films or documentaries. They will interview people for a long time and then use 20 seconds of what they filmed.
2 hours seems like. Did you get to have a break?
Did you
have a lawyer present?
It was recorded. You won't be surprised to hear this. It was recorded in my local pub, which
of course it was,
which I borrowed for a morning before it opened. And I think we met in the pub at 10:30 in the morning, and then at 1 or 2 o'clock there were regulars banging on the door wanting to get in to drink pints, and I was still there, sweating under the lamp.
How on earth do you know that much about Peter Crouch? Surely like half an hour in, you must have been really struggling.
Well, I just did my homework, Max. I mean, I know quite a lot about Peter Crouch's career anyway, but I just did my homework.
Well, look, we're very proud of you, Barry, and thank you. Although, for the record, we didn't hear the last 15 seconds of that answer because you disappeared from the Zoom call, but I presume it was thoroughly entertaining. And if Mark, Nicky and I didn't laugh hysterically at the end of the anecdote, it's because we didn't hear it. But we appreciated it all the same, and the listeners get to hear it, and they're arguably a more important part of this whole nonsense. But that'll do. But
yeah, and to think we were criticising other broadcasters for their amateurish productions. Yeah.
Now you've been cut off at the end there, Baz. Producer Joel could actually just modify the end to put whatever he wants, which is exactly what you were worried about happening on the documentary.
I mean, it's all smoke and mirrors, Nicky. It's all smoke and mirrors.
Anyway, that'll do for today. Thank you, Mark.
Thanks, Max.
Thanks, Nicky.
Thanks.
Thanks, Barry.
You're very welcome.
Football Weekly is produced by Joel Grove with Arif Islam. Our executive producer is Daniel Stevens. We'll be back on Monday.
This is The Guardian.